I have a lot of things on my mind that I'd like to talk with you about, which are related to the slides that I prepared, but I would like to just highlight something that hit the press today, because you mentioned a really important word in your introduction, which is trust. And the Financial Times just broke an amazing story about medical data, all of our medical data that we're all entering as we search our queries into search engines. It's being tracked, it's being gathered, it's against the law, and it's still happening. And I published an op-ed in The Observer on Sunday saying that the European General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, which came into effect last year and was supposed to fix all of this, isn't working. And I've gotten a ton of static from GDPR trolls and people who work in data protection and I guess fancy themselves to be gatekeepers of this topic, telling me that I must misunderstand the GDPR or misunderstand data or misunderstand trust. But the FT investigation this morning confirms exactly what I'm saying and what we're going to talk about in this conversation today, which is that the way that we are treating data is not working. It doesn't matter if the GDPR says a bunch of things, all of which I'm sure are very well intended, and yes, I have read it, in case any of the trolls here in the audience who thought that someone with a doctorate would spend 24 hours writing an op-ed of 1,000 words based on something she'd never read. No, I'd like to clear that misunderstanding up now. I have read the GDPR extensively even. And it does say great things, but the problem is it isn't being enforced. And part of the problem is the way that this is all being designed is that it has to be enforced. It's reactive. We're only, you know, it's like whack-a-mole with data, right? We are constantly relying on the media or on whistleblowers or on sheer accidental discovery to find out that our privacy is being violated repeatedly, that our civil liberties and our human rights are being violated repeatedly. That's why I think that the way we're going about dealing with data protection doesn't work. I think it doesn't inspire confidence in people. We're building a world for our kids. We've got a whole generation of kids who will never exist without going online, whose parents and aunties and godparents all happily have been sharing pictures of them from the time their first 3-month scan announced their arrival to every other aspect of their childhood. It's all online, and it's not secured. So I'm trying to speak to you very frankly today because you're an audience of communication professionals. Communicating what's in the law, how the law should work in spirit, and then what's actually happening in reality is really important. And what's really hard is trying to actually fight the good fight and speak up for kids and speak up for people's rights and getting nothing but static. The internet is not a very friendly place. Twitter is not a very friendly place. And so I'm going to be asking for your support today as we have this conversation, because it's not an easy conversation to have, but it's one we need to have, because really important decisions are made on people's data. You can decide somebody's jail sentence. You can decide their medical diagnoses. In the United States, you can decide to deny them healthcare coverage if you've got access to their medical data. So this issue is particularly close to my heart because I grew up in the United States and I've moved here and I'm watching the American eyeballing of the NHS with great interest because I've lived it. So this isn't an academic discussion for me. It's very personal. And so I'm going to take you through a little bit of what I found. It's a very quick intro. It's the most boring slide we'll have today, which is just about me, which is I'm a researcher. I'm an independent researcher, an independent broadcaster. I left working in the corporate sector specifically so that I could speak to you about things that I have learned and seen in my experience and which I wasn't allowed to talk about while I was under NDAs and working for the man. So now I'm trying to work for you, the public. And I broadcast as much as I can. I write in very academic journals. I go on television and radio at ungodly hours usually, hopefully on the World Service and World TV to try to get these messages out globally. And what really interests me is how this is happening in different countries. So we talk a lot about what's happening here in the UK and try to solve problems thinking they're UK specific. And of course, there's use in that, but there's actually quite a lot we can learn from one another. So I try to use my status as an immigrant, which is a word that's become quite charged in this country recently with a hostile environment policy. I like being an immigrant. I think it's a strength. So you're going to get a lot of different examples from different countries here. I personally think that's a good thing, particularly when you're working in data and technology, which doesn't care about data sovereignty, doesn't care about borders. We're in a global world now. So what is technology ethics? Technology ethics is something that's been bandied about as though it's new for the past couple of years, ever since the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal of Brexit and Trump in 2016, but it actually dates back. Really, we could take it back to 1938, which is the advent of a field called science and technology studies. So this is pre-atomic bomb field, but computer scientists have stumbled upon it now, so they think it's new. But of course, physicists and biologists and chemists, even mathematicians, the people who had to do cryptography, like your amazing heroes at Bletchley Park, who had to help break the Nazi codes and then decide whether or not to use the knowledge they gained to allow Coventry to be bombed, which would have revealed they'd cracked the code, or allow it to be bombed and keep the secret of Enigma. That's a great technology ethics problem. It's a history example, but it's just as relevant today. So, two pictures. This is very Western, by the way. Technology ethics, of course, isn't just about Socrates, but I just thought it would be fun to have a half-naked old man in the presentation to compliment Ada Lovelace, daughter of Lord Byron, pioneer of computer science, the first computer programmer. Ada Lovelace is amazing. One of the houses she lived in is right next to the London Library, where lots of London-based nerds like to write. So that's the way that I think of technology ethics in terms of people. But the question I think about it is, how do we create and use technologies that maximize the benefit and minimize the harm? And that's a really simple question that we can really quickly make complicated by going back to philosophy. Where does it fit? We start with philosophy at the top. We see that ethics is a branch of it. There's about seven. And then we look at the really nice, simple questions. How should people act? What do people think is right? How do we take moral knowledge and put it into practice? What does right even mean? Do we think all of the companies that are taking our data right now, not obeying the GDPR, do we think they aren't doing the right thing? Do they just not understand it? Perhaps they also haven't read the law. I don't know. Do trolls think that they're doing the right thing? Do all of us think we're doing the right thing when we're posting everything on Facebook, when we've been told, I mean, the media's reported it a million times, if you're still using Facebook, ask yourself why. You've been given all the information you need about what that company is doing with your data, right? And this is not to judge anyone here. I'm guilty of convenience and speed myself. I love being on Twitter way too much. So this is not a sort of like shunning chat. It's a deliberately provocative chat, because when you're actually the person who's in the room having to design technology, you have to answer these questions, but all too often you don't, because we're not financially incentivized to do that. Unless, of course, the GDPR is enforced and you get that 4% of global turnover fine, but no one's had it yet. We've had quite small fines so far. So is that because our regulators don't have enough money and staff? Maybe. But again, that's putting the onus on the regulator to go around doing whack-a-mole. Where is the responsibility for companies, for government, for us as citizens, to understand what data is, what our rights and responsibilities are, and if it isn't good enough to pass new laws, about which more in a moment. So you might think, who cares? I talk to lots of people in the business community in particular who think this is all very nice but isn't really affecting their bottom line, unless they're looking at it from a law and compliance and risk management perspective. What do I need to do to not get fined? What do I need to do to not have a PR disaster, right? Technology ethics is happening all around you, and if you don't take a stand on technology ethics, that's actually a stand. There is no neutrality in this space, and I'll explain why, but I just think that's really important to digest. You're going to hear a lot of people talking in the weeks and months and years to come saying that technology is neutral. It's neither good nor bad. It's people who make technology good or bad. And this really reminds me of an argument that I often heard growing up back home in the United States, which is guns don't kill people, people kill people. That's actually, of course, true. It does take someone to pull the trigger, but it also depends on what kind of gun we're talking about. You could do a lot more damage with an assault rifle that's got a bumper mechanism on it that allows you to kill 500 people in under 5 minutes, as has happened in the United States, most famously in Las Vegas just a few years ago. You can buy all that legally. That's an ethical decision to build that gun. That's a weapon of war. It's an ethical decision to pass the law making it legal. It's an ethical decision to be the person who bought that gun or to be the person who sold it. Every single person was involved in all of those people who were killed in just that one massacre. But sure, guns don't kill people. There's a lot of people who disagree with me, and what's really fun about being an academic is that I actually disagree with myself. I used to be in this group. Experts who argue that technology is neutral. I used to feel this way until I started working in it more and more. It's hard to change your mind, but I tried to do it. So Garry Kasparov, very famous man, most of us will know him as a chess grandmaster, but he's also the author of a really interesting book called Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins. This book actually inspired one of my BBC radio columns because I thought it was remarkable that he spent 300 pages writing about artificial intelligence and only mentioned two women, one of whom was his mother. That was just to say that she was smart. He didn't even see the bias in his own book. But he's quoted all the time. Ethical AI is like ethical electricity, he argues. It's agnostic, and he doesn't mean this in the religious sense. He means it in the sort of universal blood type sense. AI works with everyone, just like electricity works with everyone. Except, of course, we know that's not true. AI discriminates. Sometimes we don't even know how it discriminates, like when Apple's had to reveal quite awkwardly that its Apple Card gives a man in a couple, a married couple, a better credit rating than the woman. This happened to the Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak and his wife. It's just revealed over the weekend, very awkward. They don't know why. I'll have to do research on it. We only caught it because someone else found out about it, figured it out, and complained on Twitter. It's reactive. The way that we're dealing with technology right now is very reactive. It's not proactive. That might be fine if you're the person that's not getting affected by it, but when you're the person who's getting screwed on your credit rating, which means you're a woman in this case, over 50% of the population would be affected by that algorithm. It's not good enough. Reactive's not good enough. Paul Daugherty, who's a former colleague of mine at Accenture, is also in the technology is neutral group. Humans do it, it's the way they do it. He also thinks that ethics is central and core to business, which is really interesting then. So how do you deal with ethics if you think technology is neutral? This isn't going to be a presentation with answers, by the way. This is a presentation with questions. The book will have some answers. Professor Daniela Roos, she directs MIT's Computer Science and AI Lab, and she also thinks that AI and machine learning, which is part of AI, is neutral. She said something quite problematic, though. They're just tools by the people, for the people. We can stop right there. By the people? Do you know who's building this tech? It's not representative. It's not democratic. It is largely white men. They're largely from Silicon Valley and a few other socioeconomically culled groups, certain universities. It's not women. It's not people of color. It's geographically selected. It's in a few countries. So it's not by the people. So we can stop right there with that one. And then there's the for the people part of that sentence. We know it has an uneven impact across society. Not democratic, not fair, not accountable, not transparent. Leading one of the best universities on technology in the world. And someone who I really admire, by the way. I'm a big believer that you can disagree with someone and still like them as a person, respect them, and even admire their work. This is an intellectual debate, not a personal one. We need to really challenge some of these statements because, it suits quite a lot of people to say that technology is neutral because then you don't have to take responsibility for what you build. It's just what the people are doing with it. I question this. I question this as someone who used to think that way and who used to build that tech. What was that? What was the ooh and ah? Oh gosh, it's a sign. Experts who argue that technology is not neutral. I know I've attacked a little bit the white male demographic here, so I'd just like to reassure you that there is a white man who agrees with me on this, and his name is Sir Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the World Wide Web. He's literally building a new internet. I really admire his scope and ambition, because he's like, we've got to rip this whole thing out, which is a classic engineer thing. And I just don't know if any of you know any engineers, are married to engineers, date engineers, or the parent of engineers, or somehow are friends with one if you're not one. I love them and work with them. I'm not one of them. And I love this attitude of like, we've got to redesign the whole thing, rip it out. Because I'm always like, oh, what if we break it? And they're like, break it. Let's do it. That's how we find out how it's broken and how to fix it. And we redesign it. So he's ambitious, as we would expect from him. And he says that, you know, nothing is self-evident. If we're going to design a system from scratch, we have to think about what we're putting into it. And he's backed up by someone who I really admire and would recommend checking out her talk on the politics of AI. This is Professor Kate Crawford. She gave this talk at the Royal Society. It's on YouTube. It's probably the best 45 minutes of your life that you can spend if you really want to dig into this topic. She's far wittier and more intelligent than I am. So if I can do anything to help you today, it's to direct you to her talk. She asks a really interesting question. What is neutral? The way the world is now? Do we think the world looks neutral now? We've talked about who's building the tech. We've talked about the uneven impact of the tech. Take a look around you in your society. Take a look around London in the UK at wealth inequality, at the lack of broadband access. We talk about 5G, the new wireless telecommunications infrastructure that's going to make everything fast. You can go to parts of the UK and you can't even get 3G or 4G. Who's going to get 5G first? It matters. It's not equal. It's not neutral. And she says, for some technologies and tools, bad impacts are a design feature, not a bug. They result from failures embedded throughout the design process, not just during the application and use. It's not just how humans use it. Sometimes it really is the tools and the tech. Caroline Criado Perez has written a book that I would really recommend for everyone if you're looking for something to blow your mind. It's been shortlisted for the FT's Book of the Year. It won the Royal Society's prize. It's Invisible Women. This talks about the data, the very data that we are feeding into our machine learning. It's biased. Sometimes this is just annoying, but sometimes it's actually life-threatening. And it helps us when we read her book. And I thought I knew it all. And I have to tell you, I read her book and several times I had to put it down and go and make a cup of tea because I was just like, you're kidding me. And I'm 43. You know, it's amazing to still be horrified, to not know that we aren't even designing automobiles with crash test dummies for women's bodies. We design them based on the default of men. It doesn't matter if we find a 5'7", 65-kilogram male dummy to be a proxy for me, because our bodies are built differently. We will literally experience the physics of a crash differently, which is why women, although they are in fewer car accidents when they're in them, they suffer a higher rate of fatalities. The tech isn't designed for women. Ditto heart attacks, the symptoms of them. Women don't know what they are. They're told what the male symptoms are. Ditto the doctors who treat them. Which is why cardiovascular disease and heart attacks are some of the number, you know, top killers of women. So this matters. This is Professor Sheila Jasanoff. She's a professor at Harvard in science and technology studies, and her book, The Ethics of Invention, is extremely enlightening on this question of impact of tech by the people, for the people. The same technologies can be found from Kansas to Kabul, but people experience them differently depending on where they live, how much they earn, how well they're educated, and what they do for a living. Each one of us in this room represents a beautiful diversity of human experience, and we are all having very different experiences when we go online, publish an op-ed, show up to work, go for an interview, apply for an Apple card. It's amazing. This is a slide that I put together for people who work in business, and I would have a very different one if I was doing it for governments or NGOs. You have to check your neutrality, and it's really hard because none of us wants to think that we're an asshole. We don't. I don't think most people set out to build bad tech or gather bad data or do bad business or be a bad lawmaker, right? Most of us are trying to do a good job, and we get up in the morning and we go to work and we do the school run and raise our kids, and we're doing the best we can. So to find out that we're actually part of the problem is really, really annoying. I know, I've been there, you have my full sympathies. So what kind of questions can you use to even test yourself and each other if you actually have that kind of organizational culture where you're interested in actually building the better tech? You're going to have some better conversations, and they're going to involve things like, how do we fund the development of technology? Is there any funding we won't accept? If you're taking money from the Vision Fund, like most Silicon Valley startups, you're taking money from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. You might have issues with that, given that they sanctioned the murder of a Washington Post journalist just last year. Maybe that doesn't bother you. That's fine. Like, that's your call. But you want to ask the question, where's our money coming from? Who should or should not be involved in building our tech? From where should we or should we not source our hardware, software, raw materials? What data should we use or not use? If you get the data illegally, if you find out the data was given without people's consent, are you going to delete it? Because right now what happens is the ICO or other regulators slap a really small fine, and Google and Facebook say sorry, but they don't delete the data. They keep using it. Microsoft, when it deleted a facial recognition database of 10 million faces this summer and was exposed by the Financial Times for doing so, they'd already gotten the value out of that data, and the data set, when they deleted it, had already been copied. It's out in the wild. It's made its way into algorithms that are being used in China. You think Microsoft cares? Maybe they do. Let's ask them. How should we not use data? How should we market and sell our technology? We have to think about kids. The data protection laws that we have for children are completely inadequate. You have someone in this country, a baroness in the House of Lords, who's trying to pass extremely forward-looking children's data protection, and it's exciting. But because we've got Brexit going on, there's a lot of really amazing laws that are being proposed here to try to impress and or to improve our data protection that aren't getting through. So I really hope we resolve our political gridlock soon, because there's some amazing things happening here. There's actually some really nice success stories that we could do for a different talk on a different day. Is there anyone to whom we will not sell? That is such a hard question when you're trying to make money. But it's one we have to ask. And you want to think about your PR disasters down the road, right? Those unintended consequences. So I've come here today with quite a stark chat. But I'm hoping that it'll be kind of like when you go and talk to your pensions advisor and find out you really aren't saving enough for your retirement. Right? It's, you know, your doctor who's like, you really need to lose those extra 10 pounds because you're storing them around your organs, which means your rate for cancer and heart attack is going up. And you're like, oh, man, as you eat your next muffin. I'm with you. I'm the muffin eater. I'm the person not saving enough. I'm the person who builds the tech and like wants to make it work. I get it. I get that this is hard. But what I would really like to see is all of us understanding that this isn't just a nice to have. This is actually to help you help your clients avoid those worst case scenarios. Building better tech isn't just a nice thing to do or the right thing to do, although it is that. It's about building a better world that we're going to live in and our kids are going to live in. You're going to have a much better PR story to tell if you're on the right side of this conversation. So I've got a book coming out next year that I hope will help people who are interested in doing that. I'm really happy to have this conversation later out in the lobby, or if you want to reach out to me later on, there's amazing scholars working on this. I've highlighted some of them here. There's more of them in this PowerPoint deck if anyone wants a copy of it. So thank you very much for listening patiently today.
Thanks for listening to this CIPR podcast. For more from the CIPR National Conference 2019 and other great podcast resources, visit cipr.co.uk.